Rodgers takes the snap, third and 10, drops, pressure coming against the pass. It's intercepted, picked off down the sideline, 20, 15, 10, 5, touchdown Tampa Bay! Touchdown Buccaneers, Jamal Dean! First turnover of the season by the Pack, and it's a pick six.
Yes, you heard that correctly. That was Green Bay's first turnover of the whole season. A pick six thrown by Aaron Rodgers, who got decimated by the Tampa Bay defense. And after another packed NFL Sunday, Bill Barnwell is back to also discuss why the 0-6 Jets might be one of the worst teams in football history, how the Titans hung on to beat the Texans, and how this season has lived up to our expectations around football in a pandemic. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, October 19th. This is ESPN Daily. Bill Barnwell, it is after midnight. It is officially Monday. We just finished watching a couple games. One of them was Game 7 of the NLCS, Dodgers-Braves. So now we know World Series.
And the Los Angeles Dodgers are headed to the World Series. They win Game 7 4-3 on the late homer by Cody Bellinger. The Dodgers are National League champs.
Dodgers-Rays, which is exciting.
Yes, it's exciting for three fan bases, not only the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Tampa Bay Rays, but also the Boston Red Sox, who traded Mookie Betts to the Dodgers for the newly beloved player in the Boston area. Financial flexibility. I think you're going to see Red Sox fans walking around Boston thrilled with their financial flexibility jerseys.
And so we'll get into all of that for our World Series preview on Tuesday's show. And I got to say, it was admittedly pretty easy to switch back and forth between these two games, the baseball and the Sunday Night Football game, because Niners-Rams was not quite as thrilling. But Bill Barnwell, you always manage to find something interesting in these games. What do you have for me on that?
You go back to the Rams Super Bowl season. Late in the year, the Detroit Lions developed a way to try and slow down the Rams. They put six men on the defensive line, played one linebacker behind them, played quarters defense behind that. So basically a six-man front, a 6-1 defense with zone coverage behind it. Worked pretty well. Mm-hmm. So the Bears adopted it and have a great game against the Rams. And then eventually the Patriots adopted it and really shut down the Rams in the Super Bowl. In the following year, 2019, the Rams really struggled against that six-man front. They've been better against it, and it's kind of gone away a little bit. But on the other side of the ball, the 49ers run a very similar offense. They, of course, were very effective in 2019, made it to the Super Bowl. And early in this game, what did Sean McVay do? Maybe just as a tidbit, a nerdy sort of coach-to-coach reference, he pulled out the six-man front against the 49ers. It's only for a play, so I don't think it was like a significant part of the Rams' strategy in this game. And if it was, it didn't really work anyway. But stuff like that happens, and you don't necessarily realize it unless you're paying too much attention to games. So not a fun game, but a very small weird fact.
That is the microscopic level of detail that you can expect to get from Bill Barnwell, no matter the question. I had no idea any of that happened, but let's get on to something, Bill. That was a little bit more obvious, a little bit more dramatic. The game of this past day, it was Buccaneers-Packers, and we had Tom Brady coming off of what really felt like this humiliating senior moment on Thursday night, where he seemed to lose track of how many downs there were on that last drive. But in this game, he did seem to regain a bunch of his old mojo, connecting with Rob Gronkowski for their first touchdown of the season. And we've talked a lot about Brady's progression and regression in these first couple weeks. So where is the Tom Brady stock chart pointing now?
I think it's pointing up, and I think we're getting a very good sense, Pablo, of what works and what doesn't work for Tom Brady in this Buccaneers offense. And it's honestly not much different from what happened in New England. We've learned that when the Buccaneers protect Tom Brady, he's going to play very well. And when they don't, given that Tom Brady is 43 years old and his worst games with the Patriots came when the offensive line struggled, he's going to look bad. Brady was pressured 25% of the time in the week one loss to the Saints and 22.7% of the time on Thursday night against the Bears a couple weeks ago. The Packers got to him 14.8% of the time on Sunday. And when they did get to him, Brady was useless. He was one of four for 6 yards. But on the other 25 dropbacks, when they didn't pressure him, Brady had a QBR of 95.8. He was nearly flawless, delivered his best performance of the season.
And the Buccaneers' defense, Bill, I mean, they also looked as good as at least I can remember them being. They returned this Aaron Rodgers interception for a pick six, and they pretty much solved Rodgers at every possible turn. The guy threw multiple interceptions, was sacked four times, didn't really have anything going with that offense, which had been so good. So what did the Tampa Bay Bucs defense do to get into Rodgers' head like this? And what really went wrong for Rodgers and the Packers' offense as a whole?
Yeah, it was strange. It wasn't like the game started and he was bad. For the first couple drives, it seemed like the old Aaron Rodgers, who was phenomenal. Once he threw that pick six, though, Rodgers and the Packers just seemed to collapse. And some of it was just bad luck. I mean, Mercedes Lewis was running free for what might have been a long touchdown, and a pass bounced off his fingertips. The Packers did not help Rodgers all that much. But hey, just as Brady does not like pressure, Rodgers doesn't like the heat either. He was pressured on a season-high 29.3% of his dropbacks. And on those plays, he was 2 of 7 for 10 yards with 4 sacks when the Bucs did create pressure. And I mean, the players did their role, but I think we have to give a lot of credit to Tampa defensive coordinator Todd Bowles, not just for this game, but also what he's done over the past couple of years. He took over a defense which ranked 32nd in Football Outsiders' DVOA efficiency stat for defenses in 2018. There are only 32 teams, Pablo, in the NFL. So there were 32 of 32. Bowles does such a great job of creating these sort of unorthodox, exotic pressures, but also leaving sound coverage behind those blitzes. And on Sunday, we saw plays where Rodgers honestly was surprised and maybe a little confused by what he was seeing downfield. I mean, Rodgers looked like he had been unstoppable this season, but Bowles' defense proved to be up to the task.
And so there is a team, ironically, that could really use Todd Bowles right now. They could use a lot of things, but in fact, it is Todd Bowles' previous employer, which right now, Bill, looks like one of the worst teams to ever play the 32-team sport of football. So the Jets got shut out by the Dolphins 24-0 in a game where the Jets punted 10 times, never reached the end zone, and couldn't keep the Dolphins out of theirs. So they are now 0-6. They are the league's last remaining winless team. And as of right now, 12:14 a.m. Eastern, Adam Gase is still the head coach. Greg Williams, with multiple G's in that first name, still the defensive coordinator. And those two guys have apparently been butting heads, as they are wont to do, over the last few days. So explain to me the beef between Gase and Greg Williams, and also just give me some context on exactly how bad these Jets are.
Okay, so let's start with this beef, because if there's anything the Jets needed, it was feuding coaches. So on Friday, Greg Williams, the Jets defensive coordinator, was asked about why the defense was struggling, why they were allowing so many points per game. And Greg Williams said, quote unquote, "It's not a very good number.
It's not a very, very good number, you know, and a lot of it's not all defensively, but, you know, it's not a very good number."
As you can see, the scoring is up in the league, but it still makes me sick. And when he was asked what he meant by "a lot of it's not all defensively," Greg Williams said, "You'll have to figure it out," and ended his Zoom call with reporters. So you fast forward to Sunday, and we got, I would say, maybe the closest possible example of what Greg Williams was talking about, where his defense did not play their best, but they only allowed 24 points. They picked off Ryan Fitzpatrick a couple times. They only allowed one third down all game, just won the turnover battle, and still, we're not close to winning because the offense scored 0 points. And afterwards, Adam Gase basically said he was not happy with Greg Williams.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't happy about it, but I mean, we talked about it, and he knew that it just, you know, right now, I feel like our players are doing such a good job as far as trying to get things righted. And, you know, it's just everything we say is, it matters.
You know, not surprising, but also Greg Williams is both wrong and right at the same time. The defense has been bad, and the offense has contributed to those woes. And honestly, Pablo, if anything, I would say Adam Gase's offense has been worse than the numbers might indicate. This is a team that has scored 7 touchdowns now in 6 games. 2 of them came in the final 2 minutes of games. Jets were losing by multiple touchdowns. One was a 46-yard touchdown run by Sam Darnold on 3rd and long, where none of his receivers were open.
There goes Darnold to the 40, to the 30, breaks a tackle at the 20, 10, 5, unbelievable! Touchdown! Sam Darnold was dead to rights behind the line of scrimmage.
I mean, this is a team that has been outscored by 110 points across the first six games of the season. That's a mark only nine 0-6 teams have managed to top since the 1970 merger. And one of those teams was the 2019 Dolphins, who looked like a horrifically, historically bad team this time last year, and were favored by a dramatic margin over the Jets this week, and then covered that dramatic margin comfortably.
And by the way, the Jets are losing component parts everywhere at this point. So they released running back Le'Veon Bell last week after failing to trade him. So that star running back is now with the Chiefs. And shortly after this game on Sunday, the Jets ended up trading nose tackle Steve McClendon and a 2023 seventh rounder to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers for a 2022 sixth round pick. So what else do you think the Jets are going to do in terms of transactions? Because it seems like a lot is suddenly on the table.
The big name is Sam Darnold. The Jets are 0-6, and they're likely to be 0-8 when the trade deadline hits on November 3rd. As the only winless team left in the NFL, they're the current favorites to finish with the top overall pick in the 2021 draft, which would give them the right to draft star Clemson quarterback Trevor Lawrence. That may be Trevor Lawrence's reaction. So Darnold right now is in the third year of his deal. And this spring, the Jets have a deadline for Darnold. They have to decide on whether to pick up his fifth-year option for 2022, so 2 years from now. If the Jets fall to 0-8, if they are in the catbird seat to draft Trevor Lawrence, a Darnold trade could make sense. The Jets could get something for a player they're about to move on from anyway. And in trading Darnold, they would have a better chance of finishing with the worst record in football and getting a shot at turning their franchise around by drafting Trevor Lawrence. My idea last week, when I heard about this for ESPN, was to trade Darnold to the Colts for second and third round picks. I think that sort of return is probably the best case scenario for the Jets if they do make a deal.
So hold on a second. So the Jets, the Dolphins of last year that you referenced, we're familiar with teams tanking to get that number one overall pick. I am only now beginning to imagine the case of a number one overall pick, perhaps tanking their season to prevent themselves from being the number one overall pick. Like, Trevor Lawrence doesn't want any part of this franchise. He can't possibly want this.
We're 25 or so years removed from Peyton Manning returning for his senior season at Tennessee, as opposed to coming to play for the Jets. It's not.
That's right.
It's not out of the question.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk about which teams did okay with the COVID schedule changes and which did not.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So, Bill, we're here near the end of week six, nearing really the halfway point of this season. And the schedule has already changed so much due to this whole, you know, pandemic thing. All these positive tests for COVID, all of the chaos therein, and whether they were directly affected or not, we had nine teams that saw schedule change. And so let's talk about two of them that we saw today. So the first one, the Tennessee Titans, they went 16 days without playing due to this outbreak on their team. But then on Tuesday, they beat the Bills, and with very little rest, they went on to beat the Texans in overtime in one of the best games we saw of the weekend.
Henry is in the gun.
Okay.
It's the King Cat. Henry running to the left, into the end zone. Touchdown, Titans! Yo! Yo! Titans win 42-36.
And then the Patriots, the other team, They had all these positive tests for COVID. They pushed their game against the Broncos from last week to this week. We got that game. They lost to the Broncos. So given these data points, Bill, are there any insights we can glean on how these delays are affecting these teams any differently?
I don't think so, because with Tennessee and New England as our test cases, we have really inconsistent results. I mean, you would have expected the Titans to struggle after barely practicing, having 16 days off. And not only did they blow out the Bills, they spent most of the end of the game bizarrely insisting that the win was a response to people who had counted them out or accused them accurately of breaking the league's rules. And then
right. You
might sit here and say, well, that was an emotional game. And that was their peak, and they're going to have a letdown game on a short week. And yet they go up 14-0 on the Texans. They do blow the lead, but still have enough in the tank to come back and tie the game at 4 seconds left.
Tannehill throws the fade, left corner for Brown. He caught it. Touchdown, Titans! A.J. Brown!
Before winning in overtime. For Tennessee, it's like the layoff never actually happened. And then on the other side, we have the Patriots, who you mentioned lost to the Broncos, and they had the exact sort of game Bill Belichick would have worried about after limited practice time. Cam Newton and the Patriots offense had to overcome drops, turnovers, and mental mistakes, and they really only got back in the game in the fourth quarter because the Broncos kicked 6 field goals, and Drew Lock was inexplicably allowed to throw 2 interceptions in the fourth quarter. I think if you had to pick any one team in advance of the season and sort of try to guess who might be best equipped to handle a coronavirus-induced week off, it might be the Patriots, but they were actually the ones on Sunday who looked rusty, not Tennessee.
Let's stick on Tennessee for a second then, because, Bill, I need help figuring out what is going on with Ryan Tannehill. He had a 4-touchdown game. He's looked really good every time I've seen him play. So how big of a season could this be for that guy?
I mean, Pablo, there's a legitimate argument. He's the most productive quarterback in football right now. This time last year, Ryan Tannehill was making his debut in week 6 for Tennessee as a replacement for a struggling Marcus Mariota. Over that last year of football, from that week 6 performance into yesterday, Tannehill has the best passer rating of anybody in the NFL at 116.0. He's in the top 10 in virtually every statistical category. Tennessee's gone 11-3 in the regular season. They made it to the AFC Championship game, and they've been the best offense in football by expected points added per drive. And they're doing this with a guy who, I can't say it enough, was a cast-off 12 months ago. I'm always concerned about injuries with Tannehill, but there's nothing in this formula or nothing about Tannehill's play that makes me think he's about to slow down. This is the real Ryan Tannehill, and Tennessee happened to land on a superstar quarterback for $2 million.
So Tannehill is playing out of his mind right now, and he may keep that up going forward, but it reminds me of the larger concern we had, Bill, coming into this season of pandemic-influenced football, which was, is the quality of play going to be any good? And so beyond Ryan Tannehill, how has this season matched up with our theoretical expectations?
Honestly, Pablo, if you didn't know a pandemic had been raging for months and sort of left teams with just a handful of practices before real football began, I'm not sure you would really notice the difference. We had a ton of injuries in week 2 when stars like Christian McCaffrey and Saquon Barkley went down. But the injury rate hasn't really been abnormal in any other week so far this season. In terms of the quality of play, it's difficult to define what sloppy football looks like. But the sort of stuff you might think about when you think about sloppy football, and I don't know about you, but I think about sloppy football a lot, it hasn't been a problem this year. Receivers are dropping 3.2% of pass attempts. In 2019, they dropped 3.4%. Ball carriers have fumbled once every 69.4 plays this season. That's down from once every 59.1 plays last year. Teams were averaging 8.1 penalties per game a year ago. They're just under 7 so far this year. And yeah, some of that might be the NFL forgetting that offensive holding is a penalty. But really, Pablo, if you're watching games and don't know any better, football in 2020 looks a lot like football in any other recent NFL season.
But I do want to be fair here to the teams that have to deal with all of these starts and stops, this disruption, because in the macro, the football is remarkably similar to what we've seen in the past. But I imagine there's a level of difficulty here, Bill, with this level of uncertainty that teams are dealing with week to week.
Yeah, Pablo. And I think even if they're not feeling those concerns right now, I think they're going to feel it down the line. I mean, the Broncos and the Steelers were the two teams who really lost their bye weeks as a result of these games that were delayed late in their respective weeks. But they both came out of their quasi week off and won. And yet at the same time, looking at the Steelers as maybe the more competitive team of these two, you see an organization already missing stars like David DeCastro and now Devin Bush, who tore his ACL on Sunday to injuries. And their quarterback, Ben Roethlisberger, is 38 years old and coming off of season-ending elbow surgery. It's great that the Steelers were able to overcome their sort of bye week and win. And it's great that they were able to do a good job of preparing now. But teams also have bye weeks for a reason. What happens if Roethlisberger's surgically repaired arm gets tired in December? Or someone like James Conner gets hurt because he hasn't had a real week off from football since August? We're never going to know how much this uncertainty is going to impact teams like the Steelers, but you have to believe at some point it's going to catch up with them and end up being a disadvantage.
And so headed into tonight, Monday night now, heading into this slate of games, we're getting some more oddities because we have two games, one of which is Bills Chiefs finally happening after that delay. And then we get Cardinals Cowboys. And plus on top of all that, we have the Falcons who had a positive COVID test a couple of days ago. So just in terms of how much you're bracing yourself for change, Bill, what's your mentality like given all of this?
Pablo, I am prepared for anything as long as I know I can talk to you on Sunday night.
Bill Barnwell, we will never stop making you explain things to us.
It's a pleasure.
Up next, the weirdest commitment video I've ever seen an athlete make manages to somehow get even weirder.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story I want you to know. The weirdest commitment video I've ever seen begins with drone footage of a mountainside covered in lavender-filtered leaves and grass. Suddenly, a teenager appears in a white hooded cloak, bowing before an older man and woman who are both draped in these shiny purple robes.
My son, remember, a righteous man falls seven times.
Yes, Father. I won't fail you.
And that would all be weird enough, honestly. But then the father, who is gripping a sorcerer's staff of some kind, calls out to his son to toss him this mystically glowing weapon.
Christian, remember the 777.
Christian Zachary, the star/creative director of this short film, is a 6'3", 245-pound defensive end at Carrollton High School in Northwest Georgia. Rated one of the 30 best seniors in the entire state, he posted this video last Thursday, the day he said he'd announce his choice of college. None of the half-dozen schools waiting for Christian's commitment, from Alabama to Missouri to Oklahoma, could figure out what in the hell he just announced. And this wasn't out of some lack of imagination. Over the last decade, ever since LeBron James televised the decision inaugurating this era of player empowerment, we've all gotten used to increasingly elaborate reveals. But Christian's video, which runs more than 4 minutes long, is the first video that gives the player actual powers. In fact, it mostly reveals the answer to a different question. What if the decision was on shrooms?
Show yourself, Mr. Six.
Like, that's the sound of Christian fighting a guy who I think might be an allegory for the devil. And that's Christian, whose nickname is apparently Reverend Seven, standing before this eerie green wall with the six logos of his college finalists projected onto it, before the whole thing gets mysteriously engulfed in fire.
Remember the 7-7-7.
But just last night, in the 7 o'clock hour, we got another drop from Reverend Seven, a song this time. I clicked on it immediately. I scanned the lyrics for clues, waiting for the big reveal, the big decision at the end.
In high school, I had zero friends. If I started love, I'll do it again. And all this freaky fake.
And I now have to admit something here. When I first heard this, I felt the way the coaches who recruited Christian must have felt. Frustrated, genuinely frustrated, that I was maybe being trolled by this teenager. But then it hit me.
You know, I've been really chosen since a baby.
Sorry, weirdo. This song is not fully available yet until October 25th, when I commit.
And he's right. The real weirdo isn't the high school senior who made that video. The real weirdo is me, the adult, who couldn't help but take it so seriously. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.